Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
where would America be without immigrants?
I'd like to be in America, okay by me in America, everything free in America,
for a small fee in America.
Okay. Are national borders artificial constructions of no ethical significance?
Here you are free and you have pride,
as long as you stay on your own side.
Why are open borders good for products but bad for labor?
I started off as a farm worker picking cherries in Michigan and, you know, apples in Washington, Oregon.
Our guest is Noe Lozano, Dean of Diversity Affairs at the Stanford School of Engineering.
Recorded before a live audience in the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California.
Are national borders a good thing?
What is a nation anyway?
Immigration and citizenship. Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corners on the Stanford campus.
But we're on the road again. This time we've taken Philosophy Talk to Visalia, California, and the College of the Sequoias.
Today's program is made possible by the Arts and Lectures program at the College of the Sequoias.
We're very pleased to meet in person some of our listeners and fellow philosophers here in Visalia. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is immigration. We're going to start by trying to raise some philosophical issues about immigration and also get some facts straight. Then we're going to look at exactly what borders are. What is a border such that people should be prevented from crossing it in order to get a job or improve their life? And then finally, we'll ask, what is a citizen anyway? What should citizenship mean?
So, John, immigration is an interesting, important issue. It's a hot-button political issue. It's a divisive social issue. But really, what's this got to do with philosophy? What's philosophy got to say about immigration?
Well, immigration, like a lot of issues, leads, when you push a little bit on the basic issues, to philosophical questions, in particular the question of justice. Why is it just that some people should have opportunities and other people born a few miles away shouldn't? So in that sense, it's very philosophical.
Well, I guess you're right about that. When you mention the word justice, my mind goes to John Rawls, the greatest 20th century political philosopher who wrote a really landmark book, The Theory of Justice. That's kind of my favorite theory of justice, or at least the only one I really know well. And Rawls says in his book, well, justice is basically what he calls fairness. And what's that? You take a bunch of people, and they're going to make rules about how they should live together. Now, here's the thing. They're not going to make the rules to advantage or disadvantage this or that person because they don't know who they're going to be. They don't know what they're going to be doing in this society. It just says, we're going to have a society, we're all going to live in it, and let's make the rules to run the society.
Well, let's be concrete here. Suppose we've got the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. And we've got the three guys who are going to have those jobs, but they don't know what they're going to do yet. We get them together and they say, you make the rules that affect the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, and then later we'll tell you which one you get to be. And, of course, at that point, they'd probably say, well, let's treat them all the same.
Except if the butcher, the baker, the candlestick, put a garbage man in there, too.
Absolutely.
The garbage man has the dirtiest job, right?
Right.
And maybe he should get paid a little bit more because nobody wants to be a garbage man because it's very onerous, right? So they'll say, don't treat anybody unequally unless by treating somebody a little unequally, we can make everybody better off.
So we got the Rawlsian conception of justice. Treat everybody equally because that's what they would agree to if they were planning society without knowing what position they're going to end up in, except in some cases, everybody's better off if somebody gets a little more. And in that case, it's okay.
Okay, so how does that help us think about immigration? I don't get it yet.
All right, let me give you a concrete example. Let's go down to the beautiful Rio Grande Valley in Texas and Mexico. Two cousins, call them Jack and Pedro, live on different sides of the Rio Grande River. Jack lives in Brownsville. If a job comes up in Omaha or Chicago or San Francisco, Jack can freely travel there and take the job. But Pedro can't. He lives on the other side in Matamoros. Now, they're being treated unequally. It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem just. How does that work on your Rawlsian conception?
Well, but John, you left out something. The Rio Grande River. That's a significant place. That's a national border, a boundary between the U.S. and Mexico. And the people on the USA, we have a political community, and we make rules, and they're fair, and they're just, and they're about how we live together in our community. They're not about how Pedro lives over there. He makes his rules over there with his compatriots. We make our rules over there, and Pedro doesn't get to come into our house just because he wants to.
Well, as a fine answer, given your initial assumptions, your beginning premise, as we say in philosophy, and that's that the relevant community is the United States, defined by its boundaries. But where did that come from? Why isn't the relevant community, the Rawlsian community, the community that should make the rules affect everyone, why isn't it North America? Or why isn't it the Rio Grande Valley? Those are both more natural units than the United States. And what we do here in the United States affects people in our neighboring countries, so why shouldn't they get a say?
You're advocating a kind of view, it seems to me, what people sometimes call cosmopolitanism. You know, we're kind of members of a global community, a wide community, you know, but national boundaries don't really make a morally significant difference. Some people think, well, national boundaries really are morally significant. It's like, this is my house, that's your house, I get to say what goes on in my house, and I get to say who comes in and who doesn't come in.
Well, we've tried a bit to explain some of the basic philosophical conundrums at the bottom of immigration, but immigration is, after all, not just a philosophical problem, but a very practical one. Our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Keneally, files this report.
The city of Visalia lies in the heart of California's Central Valley. Fields of grapes, plums, peaches, and oranges stretch for countless miles in all directions, fields that are harvested almost exclusively by Latino immigrants. About 20 miles to the southeast, the unincorporated town of Plainview boasts one small convenience store and 398 squat pastel houses arranged in a grid along dusty dirt roads. Today, a group of evangelical Christians is paying a visit to see how they can help this impoverished community. In a small front yard under the shade of a tree, the residents have prepared watermelon and a cooler filled with water for their guests. The group gathers in a circle.
Buenas tardes a todos. Mire, gracias porque agarraron su tiempo para venir.
Thank you for taking the time and coming here today.
Walter Contreras translates as Hiram Gomez makes an appeal to the visitors.
Yo estuve viviendo aquí por 14 años.
I've lived here for 14 years.
Aquí mucha gente buena.
There's a lot of good people in this town.
Yeah, entonces, pero necesitamos un mejor sistema de vida.
We need a better system of life in this area.
Y es lo que estamos trabajando y queremos hacer.
And that's why we are all working together to make it happen.
Plainview is 99% Latino. Many of the residents are immigrants, and perhaps half of those are here illegally. Most people here work in the fields. Manuel Valle describes the grueling labor.
This is for oranges, and you got to put this here.
You got to climb
the ladder up and down with this bag. And you carry this 50 pounds all the way down when it's full.
The residents complain of high rates of asthma and cancer from pesticides in the air and water. Gabriel Ramos Bravo works in the fields.
The water had like oil on it, and you take it out and put it in a cup, it turns like in 2 hours, it turns green.
Irma Arroyo helped arrange today's visit. She says the town has received letters from the health department telling them not to drink the water.
So you need to buy the water bottles, for your health.
So everybody drinks bottled water right now?
I hope so, but you know what happened? So when the people don't have money, so we drink the tap water. So.
The town is in the process of building a new well to provide clean drinking water. They're also creating activities for the youth, because as 23-year-old Ramos Bravo puts it,
they're like, there's nothing to do here. This town is too small.
With little constructive to do besides work, some of the young people have turned to drugs and vandalism. Trying to counter that trend, adults have organized folk dancing classes. The children have painted a mural on the town's convenience store, and Hiram Gomez is trying to organize a soccer team, but he says it's been difficult.
We got to pay registration to the children.
And
when I ask the money for the children and the mothers,
pero, no tengo
They can't give it because you
know.
I don't ask much.
Yeah, pero lo que les haga la voluntad es bienvenido.
Whatever God puts in your heart.
The visiting Christian group agrees to help pay the fees. It's one small step towards improving life in Plainview. But the challenges continue. A freeze last winter destroyed tons of crops, leaving many people in this region without work or food. And increased immigration enforcement has created fear, as so many of the people here are undocumented. Still, they keep up hope. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California. I'm John Perry. Along with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Noe Lozano. He's the Associate Dean of Student and Diversity Affairs in the School of Engineering at Stanford University, and he grew up right here in Visalia. Noe, welcome to Philosophy Talk and welcome home.
Thanks. It's good to be home. Last time I was in COS, I think I was taking organic chemistry. But anyway, I got to Stanford via Santa Cruz and Berkeley. My parents were immigrants. But I started off as a farm worker, did cherries in Michigan and, you know, apples in Washington and Oregon and cotton in Mississippi. And, of course, there's all kinds of agriculture here, so that's where we ended up since we were migrant workers. So that's how I sort of started and left Visalia and then went over to the Bay Area.
And in your position as dean, you deal with a lot of issues that have to do with student status and citizenship. So although Ken and I have talked a bit about the philosophical issues, we would like to balance the philosophy with some facts. We don't want to overdo it. And I know you also have strong views about the history of immigration and the value of immigration to Americans. So why don't you just give us a little overview about your thoughts on this topic?
Right. I think the way you coached it in terms of fairness and justice was good, because in a sense, you know, there's 12 million illegals or undocumented workers, whichever term you want to use. And when they get places like Stanford or University of California system or COS and things like that, and they want to get educated, if their parents brought them to the United States when they were young and they were born on the other side of the border in Mexico or some other country, right, but they were raised here, they still get educated here, and as long as we don't know that they're undocumented, we educate them. In fact, my son just graduated from Berkeley in engineering, and his roommate is undocumented.
So wait a minute. So you say if the university, when you say we, you mean the university, right? If the university doesn't know that these are undocumented residents, then it educates them. Does the university have any duty to inquire whether they are documented or undocumented?
Not legally.
So basically, but once it finds, it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell. Once it finds out that they're undocumented, then they're really international students, and then it does have the obligation.
Then they get deported, or they have to go back to the country, and then they have to come back in. But if you've been raised here and this is all you know, it seems very difficult.
So if a woman's standing there on the bridge in Matamoros having twins, and she has the first twin in Mexico, right, then picks him up and walks across the bridge before the second twin comes, and they both end up at Stanford, excellent students, one's okay, the other's going to get deported. That sounds a little unfair.
Yeah, but let me phrase this a little bit differently. So, because we're focusing on illegal or undocumented immigrants, but there are zillions of, well, not zillions, but there are many, many legal immigrants. And then there are people who are here in all sorts of ways. And I do have to say that the university and probably our society, our economy at large, really couldn't function without these people. I mean, you could not fill American PhD programs in sciences and engineering with Americans. You could not do it. Right. And many of our science and engineering departments have a deep fear that when China and India, for example, get their acts together and their universities rival ours, which, believe me, those two countries are rushing pell-mell to try to make happen, that those students will have no reason to come to the U.S. And we expect them to come and stay. So immigration is a two-sided thing. It's like the undocumented immigrants, but it's also legal immigrants, people who become citizens, people who become permanent residents, people who come here. I mean, isn't that, as a university educator, don't you?
No, I think that the facts are 50% of our engineers, 36% of all graduate students at Stanford are in engineering. and 50% of those are international students. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're right. You know, we definitely do, you know, brain drain from other countries. We bring the best and brightest, and a lot of them stay here and start up companies. So their contribution is huge. So in one sense, we're bringing in immigrants that way and capitalizing on their skill sets.
So you think that the illegal immigration and the numbers raises certain moral quandaries that legal immigration doesn't. And maybe we'll take those up after our break. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk coming to you from the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California. We're talking about immigration with our guest, Noe Lozano.
We've been trying to get clear about some of the basic facts and philosophical issues that face policymakers regarding immigration. Next, we'll confront more of the philosophical issues. If everyone deserves a chance at a decent life, should borders be open and movement unrestricted? Or is that somehow not make sense, given the duty that nations have to make life good for their own citizens? Or is this somehow a false dichotomy?
And we'll answer these questions, and we'll take questions from our live studio audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
We're back at the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California. Immigration is the issue, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. We're talking to a live studio audience in Visalia, and we know out there in Visalia, this is a hot-button issue here. This is the Central Valley in California, agricultural community, lots of migrant labor here. So we want to know, what do you think about this issue of immigration? What do you think? Should our borders be open? Should citizenship be easy to achieve? Or should we be very restrictive? Tell us what you think. You can do so by going up to one of our microphones on either side of the auditorium. Our guest is Noe Lozano from Stanford University.
Noe, let's return to our imaginary cousins, Jack and Pedro, that I mentioned before. Jack in Brownsville, Pedro in Matamoros. And let's be really philosophical here. Let's think about the basics. What gives governments the right to impede the movements of human beings? And the idea is, well, a state has a right to do things that are in the benefit of everyone, or the Rawlsian conception, what everyone would agree to if they were rational. How does this work? Is it really fair? Is it really just that just because one person's born on one side of a river and another's born on another side of a river, that one can move freely all around this rich country, the United States, and the other one can't? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think philosophically for me, because the United States is, has such a highly educated population and great resources and things like that, that I think the bar should be a lot higher for us, and we should think about paradigm shifts. And I would think that instead of just creating, citizenship based on one nation, that maybe we should open up the borders in Canada and Mexico and have a Northern American sense of citizenship. And maybe it goes in stages, and some of us will be cosmopolitan or sort of citizens, and we sort of create some kind of metric that allows us to eventually move into dual citizenships or triple citizenships or things like that.
But no, I'm going to give you an analogy. I'm going to try a maneuver on you that philosophers called reductio ad absurdum. I'm going to reduce your argument to the absurd and thereby refute it by analogy here. So I've got a house. My family buys a plot of land, builds a house on it, works really, really hard to build this house. It turns out it's a beautiful house. It's a mansion, and we worked really hard to make it that way. You know, we struggled and we saved, and sometimes it fell down and we picked ourselves up. And the guy down the street buys a plot of land and builds a house, and it's not such a lovely house. And his family doesn't cooperate so well together, and they have some bad luck. And they look over and they say, well, they've got a house. Let's move over there. I say, wait a minute. You don't get to come in my house just because you'd be better off if you came into my house. This is my house. I mean, the United States is a house, a wealthy house, a mansion that we built together with luck and fortune and hard work and all kinds of things. And there are other countries that are houses too, and they're not so thriving at the moment. So why should they be able to? Argument argues our house should be, the doors to our house should be open.
Yeah, but while Noe's thinking, let me just point out that there's a lot of houses within the United States, and people from say Mississippi or Arkansas can move freely to our beautiful California, No problems asked. We don't say, how come you want to move from that crummy state of Arkansas to our beautiful state of California? Or, you know, you mentioned the Joes. I mean, what? Go back to Oklahoma. I mean, does the family analogy really fit something as big and vast as the United States?
What do you think, though? Now that you've had time to think.
I think in my sense, the paradigm I was thinking of is your house is not quite in order, as you would say, that somebody's not doing the gardening, and somebody's not making the beds. And so somebody wants to come over and say, well, you know, if I make the beds for you, will you pay me? And will you you'll cut the lawn, right? And hey, can you also work on the car that you're at it and put up a fence
and put the
pool up?
Wait a minute.
Clean the sewer.
Okay, you know. I get your point. There's a lot of labor out there that I need to get my house functioning well that's not just done by my family. That's true. Not just done by my compatriots. But you know what? When I need that labor done, I say, okay, I invite you in, and here's the way you get in. You get to knock on the door. I get to say, am I going to let you in? Yes. But if you sneak into my house and say, okay, now I'm going to make your beds. Wait a minute. Don't I get to say, no, you don't get to make my beds. I invited that guy to make my bed. Right? I didn't invite you to make my bed.
Yeah, but not speaking for Noy, but I mean, the way we've set it up isn't quite like that. You're sitting there saying, come make my bed. And the guy comes and makes your bed, and then somebody else comes along and says, you don't have the right card to make his bed. Well, I say, there weren't enough people around with the right card to make my bed. You want me to make my own bed, for crying out loud? I'm a philosopher.
Yeah, right. You know, we've got lots of people in our audience who live and breathe this issue on this side of the auditorium. Step up to the mic.
Well, it sounds like...
First, tell us your name and tell us where you're from.
Oh, my name is Rick Magnall, and sounds like you guys are getting close to my question, which is about resource allocation. And, you're talking about doing the chores in the household, but it seems like maybe a part of the discussion should be... led by an economist, because it seems that most people have the sense that there's an economic dimension, maybe that supersedes the fairness or justice dimension.
Thanks for the question. Nice. No, you want to say anything to that question?
Well, 12 million people paying taxes into the system, I think, handles part of the economic issue. I think for me, it is an economic issue, and in the sense that there are people that are getting paid billions of dollars to bring illegals to the United States. And so I think the system is broken, and we have to figure out how to come up with a better process. Since I think if you look at it from that perspective, as soon as you try to bring somebody across the border, it becomes an economic issue. Besides the philosophical, it becomes philosophical when you talk about justice and fairness and moral issues about what happens when you're crossing over.
Immigration, whether legal or illegal, is a huge, complex economic issue. I mean, it's hard to deny that. I mean, here's a fact about our world. Things move across borders. Money moves, ideas move. You can't stop capital from moving across borders. And it seems that if capital is going to move across border, labor should be able to move across borders. Right? And so there has to be a certain kind of labor mobility. But for the survival of every nation in the world, just about, there has to be kind of labor mobility just as there's capital mobility. But it's got to be controlled and regulated, and it can't just be anything goes, and you can't just be, you can take anything here and move it over there, and any person here, it's got to be controlled and regulated, don't you think?
Well, you know, by my reading, it goes something like this. Economists are pretty much agreed that unrestricted flow across borders is good for the whole. There's no doubt that it has short-range bad effects on people who get their jobs undermined by the offloading of their jobs to foreign places. On the other hand, in the long run and for the world as a whole, economists are pretty convinced we'll all be better off if people, goods, and capital can move freely and the marketplace is what determines it.
We've got
but then you say, But there's a moral issue or a political issue or a philosophical issue is, should the whole globe and the welfare of the globe be what we think about? Or should we think about the welfare of our country and be in favor of what's going to work for the welfare of our country, even if what works for the welfare of our country isn't what's best for the globe? And so it comes back to, what's a border and why are borders so important?
That's a very good question. We've got some questions from our live studio audience on the other side of the auditorium. Step up to the... Tell us your name and where you're from.
And what does that say on your T-shirt?
Got thought.
Got thought? Oh, we like that.
Got so thought. Very good.
Tell us your name and your question.
My name is Isela Gonzalez, and we were discussing at our COS Philosophy Club this issue, and one of the questions that we were thinking about was, does immigration restriction reject human rights?
Well, that's an excellent question. And if you think that all humans all over the globe are in some sense equal and equally entitled to basic rights, then you think nations, and especially if they have the power to treat some better than others, you think nations are morally illegitimate in some ways, at least if you wear nationality too heavy. And it seems to me that both you guys think that somehow nations are old-fashioned or morally illegitimate or second-rate things or something. I mean, am I getting you right, or am I putting thoughts in your brain?
Well, I think nations are what they are. I think they are somewhat old-fashioned in the sense of a nation-state that has absolute sovereignty as opposed to what, say, the European Union is gravitating towards, where different kinds of sovereignty obtain to different kinds of units. But are there human rights? I mean, one question is, where do rights come from? And one answer is like, well, rights really have existence within a community that has some principles of justice. But the problem is that things don't really work the way Rawls thought they would in an ideal state. There aren't any conventions. There aren't any agreements. Things just come up willy-nilly. And the world has got some fairly stable places where there is some attention to human rights. And it's got some places that are fairly dysfunctional. It's got some places that are completely wild. But for each child born in the world, why don't they have an equal claim on the bounty of the whole world as each other child?
Noe, what do you think?
I was thinking in a very pragmatic way, since I'm an educator from that process.
That's all right.
I was thinking more in a sense that, you know, creating, you know, dual sort of citizenships and a process for that, especially with our immediate neighbors, so that Canadians can come in easily to the United States and to Mexico, and Americans can go into Canada and Mexico, and the same thing, Mexicans can come into the U.S. and Canada. To some extent, we're doing that as we look at people retiring, as people working, and things like that. And, you know, although, you know, we think of Mexico as a poor country, I mean, this year, its economy was $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. So I think we sort of have to change some of the conceptions of how we look at our neighbors and how we, I mean, the European, when they went to sort of this sort of common citizenship, I think that they had some advantages to that. So I was thinking along those lines.
It's interesting thoughts. We got lots of questions on. I'm going to alternate sides of the auditorium. So on this side of the auditorium.
You can't hear the debate about immigration in this country without hearing the metaphor of these people jump to the head of the line. And I wanted to ask each of you, is this metaphor only confusing the issue, or is it an accurate way of stating the case?
Well, I don't think it's a very good metaphor, because jumping to the head of the line immediately brings moral considerations to the situation and makes it kind of one-dimensional. These people jump to the head of the line, and what do you do when somebody jumps to the head of the line? Well, you put them at the end of the line. Well, it wasn't a line. It was people going where there were jobs in order to get jobs, maybe in some cases very opportunistically and very immorally, but in a lot of cases because it's the way to feed their family, get ahead, do what they want, live their life as a human beings in the way they want. And so maybe they broke a law, and that's a consideration. But it's not the whole story, right? Usually when you're in a line, and somebody, you know, in a movie theater, and somebody jumps ahead of the line, there's not a lot of complexity about that issue. If you're in a line at the emergency room and somebody comes in holding their left arm and their right hand, and they go to the head of the line, you might say, well, on the one hand,
Well, that's
they jumped in line. On the other hand, they only have one hand, so
that's called triage. Though in the emergency room, you do a triage. You figure it out by need. So are you suggesting that our migration policy should be, well, who needs to be here most? Rather, that's a kind of other-centered. We think that person's need. But if I'm looking at this as a nationalist, which, you know, I think I'm the only nationalist, proto-nationalist at this table. If I'm looking at this as a nationalist, Noe, I'm thinking, what do I need from these folks? Not to what they need from me, but what do I need from them? What do you think? Are we justified in asking, what do we need from these people who would come, rather than what do they need from us?
Well, I think we're saying what we need. I mean, that's why we're hiring them and giving them jobs, because they wouldn't be able to stay here if we were not creating reasons for them to be here, right? And I think once they are here, and if they bring their children, which are younger than them, I think we have obligations for them to have health benefits and education benefits, and because they live here with us. They're the ones that are making our beds and cutting the grass and doing all kinds of stuff. So if they're sick, we're going to get sick. So in a sense, it's a really complicated issue. So if we're the ones that are paying for them and giving them that employment, and we're creating that need and that desire to come here, and in a sense, we're fueling it. So I think we kind of have to redo the policy and look at a different model, because it's not working, especially with 12 million people. That's larger than most countries.
On that observation, I'll note that you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing immigration, legal and illegal, with Stanford's Noe Lozano.
We've tried to get clear about some of the facts and some of the issues, philosophical and otherwise, relevant to immigration. Next, we're going to talk about, and we've already started talking about, the many illegal immigrants in the U.S., and should we grant them citizenship? What does that mean, and what should be the basis of it?
We're coming to you from the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Just across the borderline.
We've crossed the border to Tulare County and the College of the Sequoias, and we're glad to be here. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing immigration with Noe Lozano and our live studio audience. We want to know what you think here. We know you live this question. We know this is a place where there's lots of immigration, some of it perhaps of undocumented. It's an agricultural community with many migrant laborers. So I assume you've thought about this question. And we're going to start with some questions from this side, a question from this side of the auditorium.
Hi, my name is Eddie Aispudo. I live here in Visalia. My parents were immigrants from Mexico. And my question is, you guys used an example of an ugly house. And shouldn't the UCs or the colleges here allow students to come from other countries so that way they can go back and build pretty houses?
No, wait, what do you think about that? You're an educator.
Yeah, we definitely allow that. We do bring in a lot of international students. And I think what we were trying to do was say that if you were here and you were brought and you had been born in Mexico and you were raised here and you go to the UC, right, then you can't get a job after you graduate because they're asking you whether you're documented, and you're not. You're not a citizen. Here you got this great education, and you want to stay here, and this is all you know. You can go to Mexico, but you've never lived there, so you don't even know what's there.
Look, the U.S. could not survive as an economic power, as a scientific power, as an engineer, without all these students who come from all over the world to study in our universities. Many stay and work in American corporations. Many stay and become professors in our universities. And without that, I mean, we just would not survive. But here's the puzzle, I think. I really think this is a deep puzzle. The world is really highly interdependent. People and capital and goods move all over. Now, question, is there any room left for, like, a nation that says, we are America? This is our identity. We're separate and distinct from the rest of the world. Or is it just one big gobbledygook melting pot stew, you know, where, is there any room left?
Yeah, but the funny thing about America is our identity is we are a big gobbledygook melting pot stew, right? I mean, other countries have different conceptions of citizenship than we do. Japan, Germany, Israel, it's a conception that involves blood or ethnicity. If your parents are German, you get to be a German. If not, even if you're born there. But America's always had a fairly different attitude. If you're born here, no matter where you come from, no matter how you manage to end up being born here, you're a citizen. Now, in a way, what I would recommend is stretching that just a little. It served us so well. Why not be, if you end up here by kind of the normal flow of economy, by just walking from Canada or Mexico, someplace you can walk from, at least there ought to be some difference, some treatment that makes sense of the fact that this is a place where people have ended up, and it served us well to incorporate as many as we can into the nation.
Let's take some questions from this side of the a question from this side of the auditorium. Tell us your name and then give us your comment or question.
My name is Roman Salcido from here at COS. And when I heard the analogy of the making the beds, it kind of went to farm work for me. And the front of the line, there is no line really, because there's only a certain type of people that do that type of work out here. So what I'm asking is, if they were coming to make the beds, I wouldn't do that work because it's, you know, it's hard, it's low paying. But these people are coming to make a better life. So how does that work out to jumping to the front of the line?
No, we wanted to. What do you think about that?
I think that, you know, we have different needs, and we get to define as Americans who we're going to invite in and who we're going to have here. And I think that all I'm saying is that we need to stretch that and get a better model, because the model we have is not working, and it's not creating the ideal immigration policy, right? And I know you brought up citizenship, and for me that's a different question, and for me that is earned, and there's different steps for that. But I also wanted to flip-flop the front of the line, because we haven't talked too much at the other end. I have a friend who was a faculty member at Stanford, and he emigrated from Mexico, but he's at the other end. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, member of the National Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Google guys came out of his research lab, and he's Mexican, and we don't talk about that. Is that jumping in front of the line, too?
I just wanted to say a word about the question before. There is a bit of a difference between the state college system, the University of California on the one hand, and Stanford on the other. Stanford's not a taxpayer-supported institution. It's a private institution, and it conceives of itself as a truly international university. And you might say, well, it's a truly international university, but the tuition is so high, it's a truly international university for rich kids. But that's not exactly true. We do admit a lot of rich kids and charge them a lot of tuition, but we use a lot of that tuition to give scholarships to poor kids. And because we're an international university, and because we, insofar as we can, and we've been able to so far, we really say, if you can get into Stanford, we will figure out a way that you can afford to come here.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about immigration in a special episode. We've taken a Philosophy Talk on the road to the College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California, and our guest is Noe Lozano from Stanford University. I think there's something underlying this, and we've touched on it, but I just want to make it explicit. It seems to me there's two ways we can look at this immigration issue. We can look at it in a completely, I'm going to call it, utilitarian way. That is, immigration is a necessary thing for us. And then we ask, what are our interests? What are our economic, political, whatever interests? And how best to have an immigration policy that serves our interests as Americans, period. We can also look at it in another way, something about basic human rights and what we owe to people around the world, and how we can't prohibit them from pursuing the good for themselves, and we can't use borders to make invidious distinctions, pointless distinctions between people, morally irrelevant distinctions. And I don't know, it seems to me, if you look at it in a purely utilitarian way, you'll get one kind of immigration policy, and maybe a more rational one than we have now. If you look at it in this moral way, then maybe a nation isn't such a... doesn't have all these. Maybe it's an old-fashioned idea. I mean, the Europeans have almost, not quite, but they've almost done away with the concept of a nation as traditionally conceived. I mean, 50, 60 years ago, they were at each other's throats. And now you could just move across the European community effortlessly. Yeah,
there may be kind of a middle ground here. I mean, we have this song we like to sing, America the Beautiful, God shed his grace on thee, and I think, you know, except for the possibility there's no God, it seems to me that's definitely true. I mean, whatever it did that shed the grace, we got a lot of it. We're a very lucky country. Those of us that are alive here today, we use up most of an incredible number of the world's resources. We have charge of a lot of the world's economy. By and large, it's not because the individuals that are Americans now are so wise or just or hardworking. We owe it to a lot of luck and a lot of hard work on the part of our forebears. So we should be a little generous with countries that haven't had such luck, who didn't get such a big share of God's grace, who weren't so lucky in terms of their natural resources or the particular form of government that's allowed so much stability. So it might be to the blessed fall extra duties. And so when I see some of our congressmen who, you know, don't look to me like they've worked very hard, studied very hard, know very much, have any particular interpersonal or personal skills that make them more worthy of living in America than anyone else, go on and on about, you know, amnesty and how, you know, any kind of amnesty, even if you require these people to work for 5 years and go back for 2 years and, you know, it irritates me.
Yeah. Let's say we've got time for a few more questions from our, let's go to this side of the auditorium.
Hi, my name is Paul Beckworth. I'm an adjunct history instructor here at COS. And my question is, it's more of a statement. The idea that, especially here in the Southwest, this used to be Mexico. So I think some people kind of forget that. Well, there's a lot of Mexicans here. Well, guess what? It was stolen, so there we go. That's why there's Mexicans here.
So it's a little bit like if the house down the street actually used to be a great big house, but you jacked off a couple of the rooms and pulled them over to your house.
But anyway, go ahead with your...
If the illegal immigration issue was an issue of blonde-haired, blue-eyed illegal immigrants as opposed to brown-skinned, black-haired, brown-eyed immigrants, would it be such a hot topic?
Well, no, you haven't thought about that?
They used to make raids all the time, and they never took my father because he was very fair, very white. So that they never took him, even though he was here semi-legal since he was a federal agent. He had rights to be in here within 25 miles. So I think it does have a little bit of racial overtones, right? When I cross the border, sometimes they'll ask me for my ID, even though I'm a U.S. citizen, right? And they won't ask somebody else, and how quickly will it say, if I don't see you stop anybody that looks European, I'm going to sue you. And then you really get the message really quickly. So there's some validity there.
But I think, though, that it's complicated, because I think throughout the history of America, there's been, we think of ourselves as an immigrant nation, but there's been resistance to immigration in all periods in which there's been a lot of immigration. And a lot of it has to do with language, for example. You know, when people come over from the old country and they want to preserve some of their national heritage and national identity because that's who they are, and they don't speak the language or Americans resent that. I mean, many Americans are kind of rabidly monolingual, right? And they don't really want to be, the world speaks our language, and we don't really want to speak the world's languages, and we certainly don't want to speak the world's languages here. Right? If you come here, you're supposed to speak our language. So I don't think it's all racial. But I also think that there's some kind of implicit sense of threat that something that we hold dear is threatened. My right to speak my language and be understood in my own home is somehow threatened.
You know, America's a complicated place. So is part of it racial? I think if you look at the Congress, part of it is definitely racial. Some of these people come from states quite unlike California that are very, there's not a lot of difference. And then the other thing to keep in mind, one of my hobby horses, is if you look at the United States Senate, it's a very particular important body, the big multicultural, multi-ethnic states like California, 35 million people, 2 votes in the Senate. The little homogeneous states like North Dakota, 2 senators. So it's a complicated case, what makes things happen in the U.S.
So what do you think, Noe? What do you think about that? What's your last concluding thoughts?
I think I've realized that I'm a utilitarian philosopher and not metaphysical. I think that we have a bright future, and that, you know, every time that we've been challenged to come up with new paradigms, we have, and that I hope that we begin to have a little bit more sense of citizenship that looks a little bit like the European one. I think that model is probably the best one out there now, and hopefully we can gravitate to something like that.
Is that because you think that motto is somehow more practical in the world that we live in, or is it more respects human dignity, human right? I mean, why do you prefer that European motto of kind of?
I think we're going to a global economy, and a political structure and affiliations are going to begin to shift, and so borders are going to become harder to maintain as technological advances improve our well-being.
Well, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. Our guest has been Noe Lozano, Associate Dean of Student and Diversity Affairs in the School of Engineering at Stanford University. Thanks so much for joining us, Noe.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, we started out with the question, is there anything philosophical about the topic of immigration? I think the answer to that is a resounding yes. There's a lot philosophical about it. And one thing is this Rawlsian conception of justice, which you like and I like, and it's the best thing we got going, is clearly inadequate when we come to talk about what Noe called paradigm shifts. It's a very nice picture if you know what the community is, but what if what your definition of a community is and an interest group is unclear or changing? We need some help in philosophy to think about that, and I hope some of the young people in this audience gravitate to Stanford's as graduate students or undergraduates in philosophy and help us do that.
You know, I think you're right. I mean, I think part of the reason that immigration is such a hot button issue is because our notions of identity and who we are and identity formation and the mechanisms that by which we form our identities are under threat, are being kind of assaulted because capital, goods, people just move relentlessly from place to place. So I think it's a very complicated issue, and we're going to have to talk about this issue some more, and we'll do so on our blog, the blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
You know, and you can also download podcasts of our program from our website. Every penny spent on podcasts goes back into making more Philosophy Talk episodes. And for the final word on immigration, however, we're going to tune to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, an often heard argument against illegal immigration is that it threatens our sovereignty. A nation that cannot say who gets in and who does not, the argument goes, is not a sovereign nation at all. But what is a sovereign nation? The concept goes back to the 17th century in the Thirty Years' War, a conflict between Catholics and Protestants in what was then the Holy Roman Empire, a war complicated by politics, mercenaries, and jaw-dropping savagery. The war ravaged Europe and ended with the Peace of Westphalia, signed in 1648. The Westphalian Treaty established, at least implicitly, the principle of the sovereignty of states, of equality among states, and of non-intervention of one state in the internal affairs of another. The idea at first was to make nations responsible for their own activities. That meant, among other things, to have disciplined standing armies, and not rampaging mercenaries. Westphalia pretty much ended the Holy Roman Empire and created the nation-states that have dominated the world since. Even at the time, however, there were downsides. Some states were more equal than others. Germany, for example, was chopped up and divvied up, which led to long-fostered resentments, which culminated in the rise of Nazism in the 20th century. And the nation-state gave rise to the secular state. Kings and princes, rather than hanging out with bishops, began to hang out with scientists and merchants. The Enlightenment was born. Capitalism. We no longer had religious wars anymore, for a while anyway, but we did have territorial ones. So far from fostering equality, the new nation-states fostered rivalry, which gave rise to the immigration-driven, ultra-competitive nation-state called the United States of America, which has proved a little problematic for us. If we are a sovereign state, what are we? Chinese immigrants, Jews, German refugees, Irish fleeing the potato famine. Even today, we're a nation of drag queens, NASCAR drivers, pundits, and laid-off software engineers, united only by our desire to own iPhones. If we are a sovereign nation of immigrants, how can we restrict immigration? If we are a sovereign nation, how can we not? Even those who accept our sovereignty worry about retaining it, that we're a nation in decline, too big to tackle regional problems like Katrina, and too sluggish to tackle global problems like Iraq. The Westphalian model is in trouble all over. It helped create capitalism, and capitalism may destroy it. What do borders mean when we don't want border controls for goods, services, information, or money? We want the cheap lead-based toys for the kids, but we still want our autonomy. They want the bootlegs of our cheap action movies, but they still want their autonomy. Borderless globalism may be unstoppable, and maybe we don't really want it to stop. So we exercise our sovereignty on the only thing we think we can still control at the increasingly meaningless border, people. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Christian Anderson and to the Arts and Lecture Series at the College of the Sequoias. Also thanks to Steve Lamar, Daniel Elstein, Devon Strolovich, and Zoe Corneli.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the Templeton Foundation, and from Powell's City of Books.
Also from the members of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, even if they should.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.